Vietnam is still a name that can raise the hackles on many Americans because they were around while the United States fought a war there, a war that killed more than 58,000 Americans. Here at home, Vietnam was on TV news every night into 1975, so we get to know a lot about the country, or at least a lot about the struggles of the time. There's a great deal more to the history of Vietnam, and we learn about much of it in a recent book called Vietnam, A New History. Christopher Gosha is the author. He's by no means writing about Southeast Asia for the first time. He's written several books on the region and on Vietnam. Christopher writes in English and in French and is an associate professor of history at the University of Quebec at Montreal. Thank you so much for joining us today, Christopher.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very efficient. I noticed in the first three sentences, you got me thinking about the use of the term Viet. What does that even mean?
I'm sorry?
The term Viet.
Well, Viet first started way back when, in the 4th or 5th century before. It was a word that the Chinese used to refer to the people on the southern periphery, kind of the barbarians, if you will, something similar to what the Romans did to describe people on their peripheries as well. And so we don't know exactly where it came from, but it referred to these people on the periphery.
So I must be a fairly good example, because I realize from reading this book, I don't know much about the world before the mid-20th century, but Vietnam before the mid-20th century.
Right. Well, I mean, picking up on what you said at the beginning, it certainly was of great concern for the United States, but Vietnam has been on the radar screen for a variety of different countries, starting with the Chinese, again, way back when in the 4th century B.C., 3rd century B.C., when their empire started to grow, and it started to grow south, and they started to look to the strategic importance and to the commercial importance of Vietnam as kind of this corridor between the continent, kind of the Asian continent, if you like, and the Indian Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and that trading world that those oceans led to, all the way to the Middle East, and eventually all the way to the United States. So, if you go way back, it's the Chinese were first interested in Vietnam, which started off as an independent country, but it quickly became part of the Chinese Empire.
So it's really got a lot to do with location, that Vietnam is, in a sense, on a corner of the continent where things are happening.
It really is. It really is. You know, and after the Chinese, of course, you had others. You had the Mongols who came rushing out of Central Asia. You know, of course, they went all the way to Baghdad on the western half of Eurasia. But they went all the way to China. They took China, you know, in the 12th and 13th century. And then they tried to push all the way into that Indian Ocean, that Southeast Asia, the Spice Islands in Indonesia. But they were pushed back not just by the Vietnamese, but also by the Javanese, the Indonesians today, the Japanese as well. So it's been it really is of interest to a lot of different people. Later on, it's going to be the Japanese when they start to grow their empire, of course, in the late 19th century, early 20th century. They're very interested in Vietnam as well. They're so much interested in it that they're going to take it from the French, or they're going to occupy Vietnam during the Second World War, and they will attack the Indian Ocean. They'll go, you know, they will take the Philippines from the Americans. They're going to take Indonesia. They're going to take Burma. They're going to go, you know, into the Indian Ocean, not far from India, and they're going to do it from Vietnam. They're going to leave that Cam Ranh Bay, which the Obama's been talking about. The Chinese are interested in using that port, and the Russians, of course, are interested in using that port. But that, of course, was the port which the Americans used during the Vietnam War. So the Japanese were very much interested in Vietnam as well. And then, of course, the Americans came in. The French were there as well, and we can talk about the French if you like, maybe a little bit later on.
Oh, absolutely. There's lots of room for that. But so despite all these other powers barging in and setting up shop, you dispute the view of Vietnam as a victim of colonization and domination. What is the narrative you want to portray here?
Well, I guess it's fine to take it up from the outside, and it does occupy this very important geopolitical strategic position. But if you do that, then I think you ignore a very complex and indeed fascinating set of historical developments within Vietnam itself. So that's something that I definitely wanted to look into, is what happens if we look at Vietnam from the inside without necessarily cutting it off from the outside. What does that tell us? And I try to show in the book that the Vietnamese were often victims of this geopolitical vying, you know, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Americans, the Russians. But at the same time, they were able to take advantage of their position in that strategic corridor where they are. in order to grow their own empire, for example, towards the south. So they're going to move Vietnam, and that S that we recognize, that's so familiar to us, or it was divided at one time during the American War, but that S like Vietnam that's on the map today, it actually, you know, it started as in the Red River Delta in the far north, and then it grew itself southward, taking advantage of that strategic position. So it made them victims often, but it also provided them with great opportunities to develop their own country, their own trade, and their own socioeconomic development.
As you point out, the idea of Vietnam by that name has not been present through much of history. Let's talk about the people, though. I mean, it's more than just a singular ethnic group, right?
Yeah, that really is one of the things that's striking. You know, if excuse me, you know, you do have, I would say, the ethnic Viet who originated from that Red River Delta in the north or around Hanoi today. But as they moved southward, they moved into other lands. It's a little bit like the Americans, the Euro-Americans, as they moved westward. There were people who were there before them, and that was definitely true for the Vietnamese as well, or the ethnic Viet, if you like. So they would, well, they colonized, they took lands by persuasion sometimes, they bought lands, and sometimes they took them by force from the Cham people who were in the lowlands of central Vietnam. They moved into the Mekong Delta in the south, and that, of course, was Cambodians, and there was a great Cambodian Khmer Empire that ruled southern Vietnam today before the Viet got there from the north. And then later on, they would move into the highlands. So there's the lowlands, you know, that that go along the sea, and then there's the highlands, and the Vietnamese would move into those areas as well. So it makes it an ethnically very diverse country today.
All right, much more to talk about with Christopher Gosha about his book, Vietnam, A New History. We get a new understanding of Vietnam that goes far beyond the things we learned when the Vietnam War was going on and in the days since when it's come back into the community of nations and begun making things for the rest of the world. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Christopher Gosha. You can join us by phone or by email. We'll come back and take those phone calls and emails when we return on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Christopher Gosha, historian based at the University of Quebec at Montreal. He writes in English and in French, fortunately for us, in English, in the book Vietnam, A New History, a chance for us to understand Vietnam far beyond the boundaries of the war that the United States fought in Vietnam until 1975. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions or comments about the country of Vietnam and all its other names and peoples through the years. Welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. The year 1858 looms large in the history of this place. Why that year in particular?
Well, that it's a little bit like 1842 for China. It's when the Westerners came and they conquered. And so in the case of Vietnam, 1858 is when the French first attacked, and they're going to take southern Vietnam. And then later on in the 1880s, they're going to attack the central and the northern parts of Vietnam. And by 1885, they've conquered Vietnam, and they've incorporated it into a new French colonial state, which was called Indochina or French Indochina.
So this is essentially the same general period in history when the British took Hong Kong and the U.S. opened up Japanese ports.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the French are a part of this, and so are the Americans, for that matter. So it's the big push that comes out of Western Europe and across the Atlantic from the United States, from Japan as well, these industrialized countries that are looking for raw materials. They're also looking for markets for their industries as well, and they see captive markets, you know, in Vietnam, and for the British, of course, India, which becomes a formal British colony, you know, in 1857, if I'm not wrong. The Americans, of course, in the Philippines in 1898, and then the Dutch, they're going to go ahead and colonize all of Indonesia, more or less at the same time. So it's that big rush, that big imperial rush in the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century.
All right, so let's take it way back before colonization, though. And and when is there evidence that the first locally ruled society rise in what's now Vietnam?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have some new research that's been going on in the last, 10 years or so, which have identified a fairly unique, powerful state, an independent state located near Hanoi. It's called the Koloa State. That's C-O-L-O-A. And this is pretty exciting news. There's a lot of archaeological digs. You can visit these things. If any of your listeners do go to Hanoi, they should, make sure that they take a trip outside to the Koloa site. And this is an independent state which did indeed exist until the Chinese came in about the 3rd century BC. And then, of course, Vietnam becomes a part of the Chinese Empire for 1,000 years until they get their independence back in the 10th century AD.
So with so much pressure and ruling from China, I mean, how much cross-pollination between cultures of China and what's now Vietnam?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, certainly there was resistance, and this we know about from a lot of the writing that went on during the Vietnam War, trying to show that, the Vietnamese and the Vietnam of Ho Chi Minh, they resisted foreign powers, and, so the U.S. was making a mistake like the Chinese before. And there's no doubt about it, the Vietnamese did indeed resist. But at the same time, 1,000 years of colonial domination created a lot of cross-pollination, as you say. So that's why in Vietnam today you see that the Vietnamese gained their independence, but they're going to borrow many things from the Chinese, like the Confucian bureaucratic order, the chopsticks, philosophy, a certain type of Buddhism will come from the Chinese Empire as well. So there's borrowing and resistance at the same time, and that's what makes it so fascinating. If I could add one thing to this, is that it's interesting to compare Vietnam's relationship with the big Chinese empire on the north to perhaps like what used, way back when France or Germania's relationship with the Roman Empire. So you have these small states on the periphery of these gigantic empires, the Roman on the west side of Eurasia and the Chinese empire on the eastern side. The thing that's unique is that, the French and the Germans, they'll borrow many things from the Romans, they'll resist as well. But in the 15th century, the Roman Empire disappeared, and the Chinese Empire is still with us to this day. So that made things tricky for the Vietnamese, even after they got their independence, because on the one hand, they borrowed from the Chinese, and they wanted to borrow. They wanted to even style themselves as kind of new Chinese rulers, a little bit like, in France, the people's leaders styled themselves as the new czars, the new Caesars. But the problem is China's there, and it's there to this day.
Christopher Ghosh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Vietnam, A New History. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 as we delve in and understand this country a lot better than perhaps we ever have. You can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Hubert in Jacksonville. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Barely. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah, I know. This doggone car phone, how's that? Is that going to work for you?
That'll work. Go ahead.
Okay, I was in Saigon about a year ago, and I made it a point every city I went to hire a guide to take me around, show me good places to eat. She took me to a market, and a man and his wife there were selling jackfruit, and he asked my guide where I was from. She said, he's from America, and this guy said, oh, America, Jesus, I love America. America's great. And I said to the guide, well, perhaps you could say that, America might not have been so great 30 years ago. So she translated this, and he said, no, it was fine then, and it's fine now. And his wife got kind of alarmed at what he was saying and said, gee, tone it down. And he said, I can say whatever I want to say. So that, to me, was a window for me on how at least one contemporary Vietnamese citizen felt about speaking his mind.
All right. Thanks for that, Hubert. Appreciate that. So in present-day Vietnam, what is the attitude about the United States, Christopher? I imagine you've been there a bit.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I think, things are, relationships have definitely improved since the end of the war. Diplomatic relations were normalized in 1995. That allowed, commercial relations to blossom. That also allowed, tourism to blossom as well. And I do think there's a desire on the part of the Vietnamese. Sure, I would never say that the Vietnamese have forgotten the war and the suffering that so many Vietnamese families have gone through. But at the same time, I too have always encountered a desire and openness, a friendliness, to to turn the page and to perhaps to look more towards the future. I think the other thing you have to maybe take into account is, you know, so much of the population of Vietnam today is younger folks who never really lived through the war. They don't know the war, and you know, they're well into their 30s today. You know, if we take 1975 as the if they were born at that date, so you know, there's you know, the war is definitely there, but the younger people too are very keen on kind of looking more to the future than towards the past.
Our exposure to Vietnam during the war certainly let us know of some names that are common in the culture, Nguyen being one of them, and if we, as we go back in time, this is a name that certainly is instrumental in 16th century Vietnam.
Yeah.
Tell us about how important and influential that family was.
Well, this family's I would go so far as to say on, you know, on record live here that they're as famous as kind of the whole family of Ho Chi Minh in that they were the family that kind of moved, as I was saying a moment ago, Vietnam out of that cradle of the civilization in the Red River Delta, and they started to move them towards the south on this kind of colonial mission. And eventually, they are going to create a new Vietnam, a new way of being Vietnamese, you know. So we get to the 17th, 18th century, and this Nguyen family, they are so successful that they have basically created what is a second Vietnam in the area of Hue, and that's why the city of Hue becomes so important, because it is the imperial capital for this second Vietnam. So you have the first one, which is you know, it starts with that Koloa, that early state I was talking about a moment ago near Hanoi, but then the Nguyen are going to move towards the south. They have problems with that state in the north, and they're going to move towards the south, and they end up creating actually a second Vietnam. So it's not quite an aberration, this idea that there could be two or even more Vietnams in the 20th century, because there had been more Vietnams. There had been at least two in the 17th, 18th century at that time as well.
So in fact, there was a North-South War, which is, you know, a bit of an echo for what we had in the 20th century in 1627.
Yeah. That's right, and that's when they broke, and they would go to war. There would be a lot of battles. You know, they would go back and forth, but finally neither of the two could beat the others, so they decided just to have a status quo where there was kind of two. They both said that they still respected one Vietnam, but everybody knew there was two. And then, you know, it was a big civil war broke out in the 18th century when another group of Vietnamese kind of rode out of the mountains, out of the highlands, and they attacked both of these Vietnams. To make a very long and complicated story short, that the Nguyen would come roaring back, a little bit like Ho Chi Minh would come out of the northern mountains to defeat the French at Dien Bien Phu. The Nguyen would come out of the Mekong Delta in the south, and they would unify the country really for the first time in 1802. So again, this idea that Vietnam was always unified, or that it was always in that S shape, only really came into being, again, S shape unified in 1802.
So we're talking about the Nguyen's and the Trinh's, the two major families. And
absolutely.
The people came out of the mountains. That was the Tay Son Rebellion?
That's exactly right. So you had the Trinh, T-R-I-N-H, in the north, and then you had the Nguyen, who were in the center, still moving themselves southward. And then you had these Tay Son, these people from the west, from the mountains from the west, who marched out of the central Vietnamese mountains, and they dominated the country for at the end of the 18th century. This was a civil war between the three Vietnams that went on for 30 years. But in the end, it was the Nguyen who emerged victorious, and they are going to unify the country. And the person who does this is Gia Long, G-I-A-L-O-N-G. And he unifies the country really for the first time in 1802 until the French come in 1858, as you mentioned a moment ago, and then they will divide Vietnam again into three halves, so that the south was Cochin China, the center the French called Annam, and the north was called Tonkin. You know, and that's why we say the Gulf of Tonkin, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and that sort of thing. So Vietnam, it has resisted, it has been unified, but if you look closely at things, it hasn't, it's a new country. It's a little bit like the U.S. If you think of the U.S. when the Euro-Americans started going west with that empire, you know, it divided into a northern half and a southern half. There was a lot, you know, there was a lot going on, including a civil war. So Vietnam, something similar happened.
Christopher Gosha, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book is Vietnam, A New History. So we're getting a lesson in the ancient past of Vietnam, long before the Vietnam War, as we came to know it in the middle of the 20th century. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Have not talked about Catholics through the middle of the last millennium. How influential were they in what we come to know as Vietnam?
Right. I think you have that first layer, which was kind of that Confucian layer that came with the Chinese Empire. Is Confucianism a religion? No, but it's kind of a political religion. A second layer of religion was Buddhism, which came through the Chinese Empire as well. And then when you get to the 16th, 17th century, you do have the arrival of Catholic missionaries with the Spanish and with the Portuguese who come in the early 16th century. And it's really at that time that Catholic missionaries, they go to Japan, and when they get kicked out of Japan, several of them come to Vietnam in the 17th century in particular, and then there's a development of Catholicism among the Vietnamese in the north and to a lesser extent in the south. They were never, a dominant religion in Vietnam, and even to this day, they're about 10% of the population, until that time when Vietnam was unified. I was talking about a moment ago in 1802, they were about 7-8% of the population. So important. I don't think you can say that Catholicism is not Vietnamese, because Vietnamese embraced it as they had embraced Confucianism, as they had embraced Buddhism, and all of these religions didn't come initially from Vietnam. In a way, they're all foreign. But they were all adopted by Vietnamese to tailor them to very Vietnamese needs.
It's really interesting, though, to look at the ways that a culture will develop based on the influences that have been present. And in particular, I noticed the Vietnamese language, which I've been aware of since the war, is more or less a Roman alphabet like we use. How did that come to be?
It is. It is. And it really is one of the most fascinating things, I think, that I discovered and had to master myself in writing the book. But again, Vietnam was part of that Chinese Empire 4,000 years, and that also meant that the Chinese characters were used, obviously, by the Chinese to run their province in Vietnam until the 10th century. The thing that's interesting is that the Vietnamese, like the Japanese and like the Koreans, are going to use Chinese characters in their bureaucracy when they were working in the Chinese Empire, in particular the Vietnamese and the Koreans. But then they're going to use those characters, and then they're going to change them, a little bit like kanji in Japan, so that they represent more accurately Vietnamese words or Vietnamese pronunciations. So you've got kind of classical Chinese that's used, and then you have what's called the Vietnamese characters based on the Chinese system. And then what makes it really interesting is that the Catholics come, the missionaries, and they Romanize the language, thinking that it would make it easier for missionaries to learn the language, to proselytize, to translate things into Vietnamese, and to train their own kind of Vietnamese clergy in this Romanized language, a little bit like the Romanized language which exists in Indonesia today, or Turkey as well, for that matter. It was Romanized. And then what really gave it a boost, it wasn't so much the Catholics, it was the French when they arrived. The Vietnamese were still using Chinese characters in their own bureaucracy. So this Vietnam I talked about in 1802 that was unified with Gia Long, he continued and his son continued to use the characters in the bureaucracy. They also used this kind of Vietnamese characters as well. But when the French came, they said, no, we can't run our own colony based on Chinese characters. And that's when the French kind of resurrected, if you don't mind me saying, resurrected the Catholic Romanized system, and they started teaching it in the schools, and they insisted that their bureaucrats start using this language, in their correspondence with each other and with the French. So you have the introduction and the spread of this Romanized system by the colonizers, and then the Vietnamese, like Ho Chi Minh and others, will latch on to this language because it's easier for them to teach nationalist ideas, revolutionary ideas, republicanism, communism, all sorts of isms, if you like, to run a war state later on. So they would turn the language against the French.
Well, let's talk about what led to the rise of Ho Chi Minh then. What were the conditions and his upbringing that led him to be as powerful a figure as he became, ultimately becoming a ruler of a unified Vietnam?
Absolutely.
After the Americans left?
Well, I think, he really is a fascinating person. You can hate him, you can love him, but he is a fascinating person, and I try to show that in the book. He was a son of a Mandarin, and that means that he learned Chinese characters. That means he also knew that Vietnamese system I was talking about, but for the first time, He also learned the Romanized system, and he learned French. So we've got someone here who's got one foot in kind of the traditional world with the language and with the bureaucracy, the Mandarin world, you know, his father, and the other foot in this kind of modern world, this Romanized Vietnamese language, which opens up all sorts of possibilities that he discovers reading in French and reading in the Romanized language. Interesting thing is, some of the first things that he really discovers, it wasn't communism in the beginning. It was actually republicanism, democracy, that he was reading either in Chinese, because he could read Chinese, or he was reading in Romanized Vietnamese, or or in French. So if you look closely, he was someone who was political, thanks to his mastery of these languages. And, of course, he saw a lot of what was going on in the beginning of the 20th century. And in particular, he did witness French colonial repression in particular of the peasants in around Hue, in central, that imperial capital I was talking about a moment ago, where he grew up. And I think, in my opinion, I'm not the only one, I'm relying on other people, but that's where he was kind of politicized. But instead of going to Japan like others had done, instead of going to China like others had done, he hopped on a steamboat, got a job, and he wanted to go to the Atlantic world. He ended up in France. He ended up in London. He worked for a while in New York. He was basically crisscrossing the Atlantic. But as he did so, he was meeting all sorts of different people, all sorts of different ideas.
Well, fascinating person from a fascinating part of the world, and as you pointed out earlier, with China and Russia eyeing that corner of Asia, it's always a center of attention. The book is called Vietnam, A New History. Christopher Gosha wrote it and joined us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Christopher, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.